I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 1 year ago this week, the bombs fell on Baghdad. It was the start of a war. Shock and Awe was its name. And it continues to deliver shockwaves around the world. Just ask the politicians in Spain about repercussions there. This week in America, we will hear the administration's spin on the story. Its claims that America and Iraq and the rest of the world are all better places as a result of the war and the removal of Saddam Hussein. In preparation for this, today we'll hear the perspective of a journalist who has spent most of the past year in Iraq, talking with the people who live there. Anthony Shadid's writing has already been praised by the American Society of Newspaper Editors for its range and its power. He's here to talk about what he's seen. We'd like to have you join us. What are the stories of the Iraq war that you think matter most? And what's your assessment of the war there 1 year later? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Shadid is the Islamic Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post. He's joining us from the Christian Science Monitor Studio in Washington. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, good morning.
Nice to have you back on the program and hear your voice this side of the ocean for a while.
My pleasure.
In the last few days, Anthony, we've had a couple of developing stories in Iraq. I wanted to get your sense of them. One is what appears to be an increase in the attacks on those who are working with or for or near to either the CPA, the American administration, or journalists or others there. Is that accurate? Are you seeing that as well in Iraq?
Yeah, I think you definitely are, and you're seeing it particularly over the past 2 months. Throughout the insurgency or the guerrilla campaign, or however you want to describe it, you've often seen a shift in tactics and a shift in targets, and I think this is just one of the, again, one of the different directions that it's taken recently. There is a lot of violence on the ground, and some of that violence doesn't necessarily reach the level where we're going to read about it in newspapers or see it on television, but it is there, and there has been this marked increase in attacks on basically anyone who's working with foreigners at this point.
What do you say is happening that's not showing up in the newspapers? Is it just people being roughed up or threatened? What?
Well, I think you've seen a low-grade campaign of killings in Baghdad in particular for months and months. A lot of these are vendetta killings. Some of them seem to be politically motivated one way or the other. Often, a killing of one person or two people at a time, and it's the kind of story that doesn't necessarily get covered by the Washington Post, for instance, but it is there, and it definitely does influence sentiments, affect the mood of the place, and I think it's something that's definitely been a part of the landscape for quite a while.
And just this past weekend, with half a dozen or perhaps more American soldiers killed by roadside bombs, an assessment from the military there that the use of those bombs is becoming a little bit more sophisticated.
Right, and it's something that that's probably been the most lethal weapon that's been used against the U.S. military in Iraq. I think we saw right after the fall of Saddam Hussein a lot of hit and run, attacks, RPGs, attempted ambushes, nothing very effective. What they call IEDs or basically homemade bombs, homemade mines that are placed in the street have proven effective and very lethal. They've also shown a change in tactics over, from month to month. From just putting them on the side of the road to burying them into animal carcasses, for instance, to hiding them in bags, they've definitely been a difficult weapon to try to negotiate.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Anthony, it is a week where the administration will want to mark the anniversary of the start of the war. We've heard a little bit of that already. In fact, let's listen to a little bit now of, for example, Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking yesterday on Fox News Sunday.
I think the major achievement is that this dictator and his awful regime are gone. No more mass graves are being filled. We don't have to debate about weapons of mass destruction any longer because we know there will be none in the future. And we have taken this country that has been so brutally oppressed by a dictatorial leader and put it on a path to democracy. Schools are being built. Hospitals are being built. The economy is being started up again. There's a long way to go. But we are on our way to a better future for the Iraqi people, and that's a major accomplishment.
Anthony Shadid, you were in Iraq just a week ago. You've been back about that period of time. Is that right?
That's right.
So schools, hospital, the economy recovering, that part of Secretary of State Colin Powell's assessment, is that something that's happening that we're not hearing about? What do you see there?
I think violence at this point has cast such a long shadow over so much of life in Baghdad and Iraq and parts of Iraq at this point that it's I don't want to use the word blinding because it suggests that people aren't seeing what else is going on, but it's definitely dominating perspectives. There's a deep, deep sense of unease and insecurity over what's ahead. And I think one thing that's been demonstrated over the past year is that violence has only escalated. There hasn't been really a lull, and the attacks have only gotten worse, or maybe you could say the attacks have only inflicted more casualties each time they've happened. It's a difficult thing to deal with because there is a lot going on in Iraq right now, there's no question, but I'm struck in conversations with Iraqis as they often refer, as Secretary Powell did, to the end of Saddam Hussein. The word they use for his end is the collapse. And it struck me when they use that word is that there's a sense of something having happened, but something having not yet renewed, not yet begun again. There's no question, obviously, Saddam Hussein has fallen, but I think a lot of Iraqis are still anticipating what's next and what will follow his fall.
And from our perspective, are the stories about the violence keeping good news stories out of the papers, off the radio? Are there stories about schools being reconstructed and hospitals resupplied that we're missing?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot going on. There's no question there's a lot going on in Iraq. And as journalists, we cover what, you know, is traditionally defined as news. And people may quibble with that, how that news is covered. I do think when you speak to people, what are Iraqis talking about, or what are people in Baghdad speaking about, for instance, it is the violence. They are worried about that. It is shaping their lives right now, and it is the overwhelming feature of their lives. And to ignore that or to not appreciate the effect it's having on that cult, on that society, I think would be almost a disservice as a journalist. Mm-hmm.
There's a story that you have done over the past year that I'd like you to talk a little bit about, which I admire because it's in a way you touch down and then you come back and you come back, and it helps, I think, understand our depth of how people are feeling. This is the story about Karima, a woman that you met during the bombing last year, right?
That's right.
And she has 5 daughters, 3 sons. When you first wrote about her, Anthony, I was reading it over the weekend, I was struck by the fact that you didn't use her last name. You didn't name her son. It was the type of reporting that went on when Saddam was still in power. You had to be very careful of what you said.
Yeah, that's right. It was, back in the war, we were still dealing with a government and dealing with minders. And it was one of the real challenges of reporting to try to basically lose your minder, to try to get as much as possible unvarnished opinions. And I was able to visit Karima on my own. She had just sent her son off to war to Mosul. He was going to man an anti-aircraft battery, which was a pretty bleak prospect, to be honest. A position like that up in the north when there was such an aggressive air campaign going on. And that was when I met Karima, and I was able to talk to her about, you know, sending her son off to fight, and then also the situation of her life in this limbo that had already begun even during the war, that people knew that there was going to be change. They just weren't sure what kind of change was going to happen.
And then you go back a year later. You're able to name her. Karima Salman is her name, and talk a little bit more in greater detail about her family. What was it about this woman and her children that gave you the insight into the way ordinary Iraqis have experienced the past year? What struck you about that, Anthony?
Well, I think what struck me about Karima's family was that, you know, in looking at her life, it was probably most remarkable for how unremarkable it was. It was a pretty bleak existence, and I was able to spend time with Karima and her family through the year, trying to visit them every month, every 6 weeks, and just kind of gauge how their lives were unfolding. And to what I think for a lot of Iraqis is the most, you know, are the most momentous months of their generation, at the very least, and probably their lives. What you saw in Karima was, you know, sentiments did get very nuanced, and they did break down as the year unfolded. You saw Karima as almost the kind of way I sensed it was as a lost generation, somebody whose life was so wrecked in a lot of ways by the government, by 35 years of the Ba'ath Party's repression, that there really wasn't a sense of hope. It wasn't a sense of what's next. There was just a real desire for stability and security, and it became a mantra for Karima. You know, this idea that I don't care what happens ahead, just so things don't change, because often for Karima, change was more hardship. I think you saw a much different perspective with her children in a way. Her oldest son, who did go off to fight, he came back, and as the year went on, he became very disillusioned and very disenchanted. And in conversations with him, I heard the kind of conspiracies and the deep suspicion you hear about what the U.S. administration is doing in Baghdad, and he was voicing that as the months went on. Probably the most, to me at least, as a reporter, the most fascinating person in that family was her daughter, though, her middle daughter, who kept a diary through the war. And it was a very poignant diary in a
this
lot
is
of ways.
Amal.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And she, you know, it went from just a kind of a chronology during the war almost, this is what happened today, the bombs fell, we tried to hide, we didn't want to get hurt, to a mind of a 13-year-old opening up as the months unfolded. And it was a remarkable development, I think, of this young girl who began to think critically and began to try to think for herself and create her own opinions. And in a way, it was a very personal, I thought, reflection on what the end of Saddam Hussein meant, that there was this freedom to think in a different way.
Because she starts the year, as children that age would, believing that what she's been told in school is accurate, that Saddam Hussein is, well, I mean, I'm not sure how much of it she believes, but she certainly doesn't challenge the status of the president. And you can see through her writing, her raising all these questions about, is it okay to question him? Is it all right to say he was a bad man?
Right. And it took weeks, you know, weeks. I mean, I think we're so used to, in the West, of knowing the record of the previous Iraqi government, knowing its crimes. For, you know, for people like Karim and her family, it wasn't something that they were really aware of. And you see in her diary, talking about Saddam Hussein, or the teacher telling them to rip out the pictures of him in their textbooks, of watching these, you know, videos that you could rent for 50 cents that detailed his crimes, of people talking about this. And for the first month of the entries after the war, she's very confused, and she's almost waiting for Saddam to return. The idea of him being gone permanently just mm-hmm. wasn't really something she could believe.
And you write about Karima, the mother, that a year on, the war has yet to end. Is that how the mother and her children see the life that they lead now? I'm trying to use that idea to not only mark where they are, but what they see ahead for themselves.
Right. It's definitely still a process unfolding, and that's what I mentioned earlier. They do refer to this, to the end, as many Iraqis do. They refer to the end of the government not as a liberation, not as an occupation, not as however you want to describe it. They refer to it as a collapse or the fall. And I'm always struck by that choice of words, because it does mean the end of one thing, but not yet the beginning of another necessarily. And so I think when you do speak to Karima, it is, when are we going to have a new government, a strong government? When is there going to be security? When are we going to have security again, or stability again? Mm-hmm. And these are the ideas that dominate her existence, because anything short of that only creates, you know, more unpredictability, and that's the last thing she wants to have to negotiate.
Her son Ali looks at the coalition provisional authority people roaring around in their armored vehicles and concludes that really that's just the same as what they would see with Saddam and his sons roaring around Baghdad. Is that a widely held point of view?
You know, Ali is definitely an angry young man, and you know, it's not all that surprising given what he's gone through over the past year. You know, I think there is what you hear, the criticism you hear of the governing council most often among Iraqis is this charge of corruption. It's not, you know, there is the idea that they are somehow maybe tainted, and I'm not sure the word you want to use, but somehow tainted possibly by their association with the U.S., that they're ineffective. But definitely the biggest criticism is corruption. And I think corruption's only, you know, only amplified by the economic conditions that really haven't gotten better for a lot of people in Iraq today. That seems to sharpen this anger over seeing the sports utility vehicles, for instance, or the bodyguards. Somehow they have a position that they don't necessarily deserve.
Connection listeners, it is 1 year this week since the beginning of the war in Iraq. My guest this hour, Anthony Shadid, award-winning reporter with The Washington Post, who has spent the last year there, in fact just came back a week ago, and is heading back later this week. What questions do you have about life and the situation there that you think will help you better understand where we are 1 year after the start of that war? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Anthony Shadid is with us for the hour. He is Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post, based in Baghdad, has been there for the past year. Anthony speaks Arabic, which gives him a chance to get a little closer to the story than those of us who go over there and have to rely wholly on or entirely on the translation skills of fixers and translators. It gives him a little bit better insight into the story. And he's here with us to take your questions, your calls about what's going on in that country now. Let's take our first call from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and Kevin's joining us on the line. Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks.
Mr. Shadid, welcome home.
Thank you.
Privilege of meeting you when I was a fellow at the MIT Security Studies program. I got back from Iraq on the 5th of July. Since you've been there a lot longer now, I'd like to know, since you're a process observer, the insurgency, do you think it's still mostly Ba'ath Party remnants, or has there been a rise in foreign fighters or jihadists?
You know, it's a good question. And I'll tell you, it's probably one of the most frustrating things we've had to cover the past year, because there is so much uncertainty. And there's, I think, especially over the past couple of months, there's a reluctance to dig too deep into that story because of the repercussions of that kind of reporting. People who have done that have had their assistants, their drivers killed. And I think that it's kind of made the reporting maybe a little less aggressive on what's going on with the insurgency. You know, my sense, I think, and Grant, I think there is still much so uncertainty on this story, but my sense over the past year has been that it was Ba'ath Party, remnants of the Ba'ath Party that were taking the lead on the insurgency, particularly in these kind of assassinations and killings we've seen going on in the capital. You know, the violence, though, recently, and I was in Karbala when scores of people were killed by these, a series of bombings unleashed on the most sacred Shiite Muslim holiday. You know, the carnage, those attacks felt different to me, and maybe it's just a gut feeling, maybe there's not too much to read into it, but I didn't get the sense that there was a political message, that there was not a political message in those attacks, and that's something that I thought had characterized the insurgency. However disfigured, however twisted, there was a certain political message in the targets chosen. You know, what we saw in Karbala last month was just carnage, just the desire to kill as many people as possible, and it did give me a sense, at least, that there was somehow perhaps different people behind it, a change in strategy. I'm not really sure. It is a difficult question to answer.
When did you come back from Iraq, Kevin?
On the 5th of July.
And so you've been watching it closely since then. Was there a time when you wondered, I'm asking you the question because I wondered this, I'm just wondering what your perspective is. Was there a time when you wondered, look, are these guys going to run out of people, run out of explosives, run out of energy to attack the Americans?
No, actually, I never felt that. It was just a question of when could we establish conditions for security and how long was that going to take, since this is a war and war is a human endeavor. It's a battle as much for the minds of the people and to exert our will on the enemy as much as anything else.
And are you any closer to thinking that the U.S. is any closer to succeeding there?
Well, I don't know. I run a school for planners, and I'm trying to train these young men and women to go into battle and to do our best to set those conditions for the Iraqi people, as well as do our best for our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines.
Yeah. And Anthony, I think you could probably argue both sides, that there are ways to measure success, but also ways to measure failure in the last few months. What are your scales telling you here? Is it a balance? Or?
You know, I think it's such a hard question to answer because it is such a complicated landscape. And there are successes and there are failures, there's no question. I'm struck in as a reporter, as a journalist on the ground, and when you speak to people, this aspect of insecurity and this unease over the violence is, like I said earlier, is a very, very powerful current in sentiments today. And I think almost overwhelming to a lot of people, just the sense that things aren't necessarily going to get better when we talk about violence, that the attacks are going to get worse. And there is a deep fear among Iraqis that, as the caller pointed out, that there are foreign fighters coming into the country, whether their numbers are overstated, whether it's just a way to try to explain violence that people aren't quite understanding or coming to grips with, that may be, but there definitely is a sense that Iraq is perhaps becoming a battleground of outside players that it wasn't, a year ago.
There's a hole in my own understanding of what goes on there, Anthony. I mean, I kind of get the religious divisions. I understand the geographical interests of people in different parts of the country and the ethnic divisions there. But I get so tangled up in the tribal and the clan issues there. Is that a hard thing to try and penetrate as a reporter?
You know, it is because I think a lot of reporters who were there before the war didn't understand the depth of traditions, of the tribal traditions, and how powerful a force they exerted over society. It's not necessarily difficult to cover. People are very open about it, and they will talk about it. I think it's just to maybe understand how far it reaches, how far these traditions do shape life. And I think especially in a certain vacuum of authority we've seen since the collapse of the government last April, tribal traditions, tribal authority has risen to fill that vacuum to a certain extent, and so it's exerting a greater influence on life right now.
There's a couple of stories that you did from Thaloya last summer, which stick in my mind as an example of perhaps what's less well understood in this country. It had to do with someone who was marked. This is in a June story that you wrote. Someone who was marked as being something of a traitor. Singling out men in Thaloya for the U.S. Soldiers to pick up. You know the one I'm talking about?
I do.
Now, you went back again in August, and that was where the powerful story came from. Can you tell us what you saw in June, why you chose to go back, and then what you saw in August?
You know, I went in June after there was a U.S. military operation there, and I forget the exact number. I think three or four Iraqis were killed in that operation. And I remember in the village at the time, which is about an hour and a half north of Baghdad, there was a lot of anger over someone from the village who had pointed out people that were suspected of working with the Ba'ath Party or suspected of having a role in attacks. Because people in that village had died, many of the villagers were angry over this person's role, and it was clear that they wanted revenge. And so I went back later to see how that story had resolved, and it was... For that person, it resolved very badly. I mean, his father, the villagers went to his father and told him that either his father killed him or they would kill his family. And the father did kill his son. He killed his son along with his, both the father and the brother killed the son. And I spoke to the father at the time, and I remember it was, you know, it was trying to understand something that really, I don't know if you can understand. And he made a remark to me that I don't think I'll ever forget as a reporter. And he said, "Even the prophet Abraham didn't have to kill his son." And then he went on to say that I had no choice. What else could I do? And it's, you know, I've tried to keep in touch with that story as the months go on, because I think it did. I found it very difficult to report and to write in a lot of ways. And I think one of the ironies of it now is that the U.S. military is seeking this father, you know, for murder. And the same village that forced him to kill his son is now actually sheltering him and protecting him. I think it just shows the complexity of these relationships and these and traditions and how they run in ways that we probably won't be able to understand.
Connection listeners, 1 year after the start of the war, is Iraq any better off? Is this a war that the United States is winning, or is the United States winning the hearts and minds of people in Iraq? What's your perspective? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Anthony Shadid, reporter for The Washington Post, who has spent the past year there. We're going to go to Willsboro, New York. Carol is joining us on the line. Carol, thanks for calling.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
All right. I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with you, Mr. Shadid. I've had an area that I've been curious about ever since the initial shock and awe operation began, and that was the effect. We had little reporting on the effect of the Iraqi people themselves, the destruction of their homes, the old people losing a lifetime worth of things that they've gathered, the injured civilians and children, and I'm wondering how, if that still has an effect, and how the people view the United States today, and also how that's being addressed by the United States government there.
You know, it's an interesting question that you point out, Liz. You know, what is the legacy of the war? What lingers from the war? And I was struck in covering the war is that, you know, I covered it from Baghdad, and so I only had the perspective of Baghdad to go on, but. While the bombing was very precise most of the time, it was not always precise, and there were mistakes made. But the war, especially in its last days, was a very bloody project, and I think there is some lingering resentment over the scale of the violence. Not that it was avoidable. I mean, it is war that we're talking about. What I guess I'm struck by in looking back on that time is that there was a certain sense of optimism in those first couple of weeks after the war. There was a hope and a great desire that lives were going to get better, that they'd come through, you know, two wars, a decade of sanctions, another war, and that finally they were going to get a break, basically, that they somehow could enjoy their lives a little bit more. But what you saw in those 2 weeks was the looting. And the looting, you know, I look back on how sentiments have unfolded or how people have talked, and those 2 weeks were decisive, I think, in a lot of ways on what was ahead. You know, we saw the government fall. There was that hope, there was that optimism, and then there was looting that, in a lot of ways, scarred the Capitol far greater than any bombing ever did. The looting wrecked the Capitol. It wrecked the government ministries, a lot of buildings, a lot was stolen. And I think that started this kind of process of disillusionment or disenchantment that you hear voiced often in Baghdad, is that you know, if the United States, it is such an unbelievable power, such an overwhelming power, and it could prosecute this war so brilliantly in a lot of ways, it could overturn or overthrow a government that had lasted for more than 3 decades, and they could do it in 3 weeks. Why couldn't they do the same thing in peace? And I think that's the what they see as a contradiction that people have tried to or that are wrestling with now, and they've tried to reconcile, and they haven't done it yet.
I should mention for our listeners that some of the stories of Anthony's that we're talking about on the program today, we'll have links to on our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. And in fact, the piece that you wrote in today's paper, Anthony, about Dr. Fuad Musa Mohammed, in many ways illustrates exactly what you're talking about. This is the retired psychiatrist in Mansoor who's so happy in the days after Baghdad falls. The quote in the story from a year ago is, "As long as America is here, everything will be better and the future will be brighter." Tell me about the man today, what he's thinking, what he's saying now.
He's a remarkable character. It's someone, again, I met during the war, and we sat alone in his house during the war. And, you know, I couldn't believe the way he was speaking to me. It was just, you know, a lot of candor. And I think I remember him saying to me, "He's finished," referring to Saddam. And, you know, even to say these words, even as the war was about to end, mm-hmm. to say those words, you know, you weren't used to it at the time, to hear somebody speak so bravely and courageously. I went back to see him a little bit later, and I remember walking into his house, and he yells, "Victory," you know, "Victory," throws his hands up to the ceiling, and he's overjoyed. And there was such a great degree of optimism with Dr. Fuad. He was so excited about the future. And, you know, at a time that there was already some frustration over electricity and the collapse of infrastructure, he was one that was counseling patients. He said, "Just, you know, give the Americans time. It's going to get better. Don't worry about it." And I saw his mood change as the year unfolded, in October in particular. And then we were sitting, you know, for quite a few hours in last month, in February, talking about what had happened. And it was, you know, a sense of desperation had almost set in with Dr. Fuad. I mean, he was very upset and angry. And you even started hearing these suspicions about, "I don't understand why it's not getting better." And that suspicion sometimes runs into the territory of conspiracy and paranoia. And I think it's too strong of a word, because Dr. Fuad is a very intelligent man. But he's someone who is a doctor, and he's used to treating and diagnosing an ailment and then treating that ailment. It's a very rational mind. And what he sees around him often is you know, defies that kind of rationalism. And he's trying to explain it. And, you know, like I said earlier, for him and a lot of people, they haven't come up with the answers yet.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take our next call from Warren, Rhode Island. John's on the line. John, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. Basically, my question is already falling in line a couple of the answers that you already had. I'm one of the supporters of the war, and for me, the reason why I support it was I thought it was the best choice of a lot of bad choices, meaning we could have kept the sanctions on, another 250,000 people over 10 years would have died. We could have asked them to rise up as a civil war, and we already saw that right after the first Gulf War, and there was 100,000 people that died. Or what people are now yelling at us now, saying there's no weapons of mass destruction there. Well, that implies that what we should have done is take off all the sanctions and let Saddam Hussein free. And, yeah, we've screwed up a lot of things in the post stuff, but this is also really tough. I don't know. I mean, can you just kind of, I guess, keep on expanding on what the thread that you've already been kind of talking over the last two questions?
I think it's incredibly tough, and I think you bring up a good point. One thing I'm struck by, and I think, you know, it's sometimes hard as a reporter to try to be as nuanced as possible when you talk about people's sentiments, but it always strikes me as that, you know, when you look at the landscape of how people are feeling in Baghdad right now, it's probably no different than how Americans were feeling after September 11th. A lot of conflicting emotions. Some of them might even sound contradictory, but they're all out there. And Dr. Fuad, who I was just talking about, is a great example of that. Here's somebody who, I mean, wouldn't think twice about endorsing the war. It was the best thing to do. It got rid of Saddam. But he also is unsettled by the occupation. He's unsettled by the reconstruction. He still, you know, is an admirer of the United States, a great admirer of the United States. His son studies here. His daughters are all Western educated. But there's great frustration with how it's unfolded. And I guess that's how I'm kind of struck in looking back at Baghdad over the years, that nothing fits into easy categories. And there is a lot of talk out there, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. There's still resilience. And I think if one thing defines Baghdad, it is that resilience. There is hope, and there's also a sense of dread and a sense of unease over what's ahead. So, you know, it's like I said, it's kind of hard to fit it into one category. It's all over the place. But I guess I am kind of struck by how the bleakness of the mood, I guess, in the most general terms right now in the capital.
John, back to you. Do you think it is reasonable or unreasonable to try and pass some kind of judgment on the occupation or on the reconstruction or on this moment of people in Iraq? Is it too soon?
One sense, I think it's too soon, because, if you look at the occupation of Germany, this was 5 to 10 years, and if you read articles 2 years when the Marshall Plan was starting to go on.
You know, we could just go to the beginning of the 90s when Russia all fell apart. Every bit of life that the Russians knew at that time had collapsed, and there were people in the early 90s saying, we'd like Stalin back, we'd like the Soviet Union back, anything is better than this. I see a parallel there. And I mean, it's been 10 years and people in that country are still going, well, things aren't a lot better.
For me, it's a determination basically 5 to 10 years is when we should start really kind of judging this. And, that's where I'm crossing my fingers. And for me, as an American looking at this and seeing all the world reaction we saw, Spain basically reacting against this and saying they're going to pull out the troops. And I'm sitting here going, what is the world thinking? We need to fix this problem now. And I, the frustration, as I said, my beginning of my question is, nobody gave me a good choice as a supporter of this. They all basically said we should do nothing. And nothing to me was not acceptable.
John, thanks for your call. We'll pick that up with Anthony Shadid when we come back after the break. And Connection listeners, no good choices is the way that John puts it. We're also talking about assessing the occupation, the reconstruction, 1 year after. Is it a reasonable time to make that judgment? Certainly Iraqis are assessing it every day. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Anthony Shadid is my guest this hour. He was on the program some time back talking about a book that he'd written called Legacy of the Prophet, Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. There will be a book coming from his past year's experience in Iraq, but it's still in the writing stages. Anthony is spending a week or so in this country before going back on Wednesday to continue his coverage there. He's here to take your calls and questions about Iraq, 1-800-423-8255. Anthony, before we go back to the calls, just a response on what John was saying and as to whether or not it's reasonable or unreasonable to try and make a judgment 1 year later.
It's a very, very valid observation. How will it be measured? When will it be measured? I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. I know a lot of Iraqis are measuring it now, but they can't help but measure it. It's their lives we're talking about.
But can they wait another 5 years? Can they sustain this type of life for another 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
You know what strikes me is that in almost every conversation you have in Baghdad today, civil war will come up in one form or another. Now I don't think civil war, it confused me for a long time as a reporter. What exactly do they mean by civil war? And I don't think what a lot of people are talking about is Kurd, Arab, Sunni, Shiite, somehow that you're going to have front lines and different groups within the society are going to go after it. I don't get that. I don't think that's what exactly they're talking about. I think more what they're talking about when they refer to civil war is that there's been a progression of, there's been growing disorder, growing threat of violence, a growing danger in society. And civil war is in a way a metaphor for just the logical consequence of that. If it gets any worse, it will become civil war. And I think that's why people talk about it in those terms so often, is that there is a fear that things are getting worse and that if they could get any worse, then you'd have this kind of apocalyptic scenario or, anarchy or chaos, and that's and civil war becomes the metaphor for that.
And people are saying this is where the country is headed, or this is where the country could go if something doesn't intervene to stop the current situation.
I think it's both. I think you hear could go, is going, may go, hopefully won't go.
Yeah, right.
I think it's, you know, it's definitely all over the map of where people think things are headed. But there is a sense that the violence has only escalated. And like I said, that colors pretty much everything people talk about.
Let's go to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Bob's on the line from there. Bob, thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, I'm operating on the information that I have basically from the media, which is all I know about Iraq. How realistic is it to assume that we can, or democracy can be installed in a country that is, that I know of, three very disparate nations, if you will? How realistic is it to be able to assume that we can install a democracy or a system of government similar to our own, basically foisting it on the area when our democracy doesn't seem to or deal with these three disparate nations?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's an area that I've always been interested in and trying to understand in covering Iraq over the past year. You know, one thing that strikes me about Iraq is that, you know, oftentimes people bring up the example of the occupation of Germany after World War II. Germany wasn't colonized, though, and Germany wasn't in the setting of the Arab world with its history and its grievances. And I think that's one thing to always remember is that Iraq is very different than a European country. It does have this history of British colonialism. It does have, you know, it does have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that still in some ways colors sentiments in Iraq. And there's a danger, I think, in some of the rhetoric about democracy, or I think some people perceive a danger in it, that it becomes maybe a code word for a change of culture, for instance, or a change of traditions, and it takes on a very different look in that sense. And I think that's when you talk to Islamic activists in Iraq, that's definitely their fear. They're not going to argue against the notion of democracy by any means. In fact, they'll try to explain how democracy can somehow fit together with Islam. But there is a fear that democracy is going to be part of, for instance, globalization or some of these other forces that are going to change the essence of Iraqi identity. And I think that's where you get these fault lines. This is where conflict arises a lot of times.
I know you've spent a lot of time traveling around the country, Anthony. How much of the story is Baghdad, and how much of the story is somewhere else in Iraq? I mean, Basra, for example, the city, what is it, the second largest city in Iraq, and it's never in the news.
That's right. It's, you know, it's a danger, and I think it's a, you know, it reflects on the limitations of our profession as much as anything else. You know, we are based in Baghdad, and Baghdad naturally dominates our coverage as a result. You know, we do try to get around, we do try to see what's going on elsewhere, and it is a different picture. There's no question about it. I mean, I think Baghdad in a lot of ways is the place where all the fault lines come together in Iraqi society, and it's a more explosive place in a lot of ways, and it also is you know, without question, the most important city in the country. It is the capital, and what happens in Baghdad does guide events that happen elsewhere in the country. But like you pointed out, you know, Basra is the second largest city, and we don't do a good enough job covering Basra. It does have a different feel. There are different issues going on there, and you know, my wish is that we could spend more time in these places. When the previous caller had asked about democracy, one thing that struck me, I was in Nasiriyah a month ago, and here was an example of where the U.S.-led administration had carried out a series of elections. Now, they weren't full democratic elections. They were, each family had two votes, one for a man, one for a woman. But, you know, over a process of months, a period of months, they had carried out a process that created elected councils in, I think, more than a dozen of the largest cities in the province. It was a spectacular example of how things can work, and it worked very well there. That's a story that we, you know, don't always get to see all that often because it did happen in a place that was pretty hard to get to.
You did a piece, I remember, from Najaf about real estate prices going up and hotels being full. And, I mean, there was an almost an exuberance to how much money was to be made by the people who had lived in that city under the thumb of Saddam Hussein as sort of oppressed Shiites for so long.
Yeah, you know, Najaf and Karbala, these two cities are, if there's been a dramatic change for the good anywhere, it's in those two cities since the collapse. There's a renaissance going on in both of them. And I think that was what was, you know, so devastating for a lot of Karbala's residents when the bombings did happen there, when the scores of people were killed, because these are cities that are enjoying the good times right now. There's a lot of money going in there. There are pilgrims going to their sacred shrines there. They're doing very well. And, you know, the scale of the carnage that we saw in Karbala last month just, you know, it was very bitter for a lot of people, I think. Not obviously the sense of loss. I mean, so many people died, but also, you know, why can't they leave us alone? Why can't we just keep on with our lives that are in those two cities at least getting better?
And yet you say that you've been surprised at the rise in profile of the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think when Saddam did fall, Saddam, you know, one of his greatest legacies perhaps was the ability to depoliticize the country. There just weren't institutions left after 35 years of Ba'ath Party rule. And one of the very few institutions that did survive was the clergy, based in Najaf. And the clergy has continued to exert a great degree of influence over Iraqi life, and they will continue to exert a great degree of influence. In contrast to Iran, where the clergy has been discredited by the experience of the revolution and what followed, it has not been discredited in Iraq. The clergy still carries great weight. And I think what you've seen with Grand Ayatollah Sistani is, among Shia at least, who are the majority in the country, him setting himself up as an independent arbiter, somebody who's not linked to the Americans, is not linked to other interests, even though he's not an Iraqi. He's an Iranian by birth. But he's created an authority where he's an independent voice. And that's I think, to a lot of Shia, that's a very critical role to play right now.
But it's also revealing, if we go back to the story that we began the hour with of Karina, when in her search for any kind of joy in her life, about the only place that she finds it is at the mosque.
It's right. I mean, and we're talking about different things here. Well, they are linked in some ways. But, you know, I think if you look at what's maybe the legacy of the war, what's the greatest legacy of the war right now, we can judge that, I think. And we can say that religious freedom has been the one thing that we didn't maybe expect to flourish as it did, but one thing that has flourished and could have only flourished with the fall of Saddam. And I think especially among the Shia, there is total religious freedom, something they haven't enjoyed in decades. And with Karima, this is something she looks to. It's a sentiment of solace and survival in a way, and it's something that she can cling to. I think I referred to it in the story as it's, you know, in a place where there are very few constants, it is a constant in changing times.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark's on the line. Mark.
Yes, hi. I responded to another caller earlier who posed the dilemma, what were we to do, knowing what sort of government was there in Iraq? And I think it's a really good question, but the problem that arises is that given the history of our government telling us the truth about why we're becoming involved in foreign adventures, it was very hard for us to trust what they were doing, still hard for us to trust. We know CIA involvement with Allende, with the Shah. I think a lot of the American public is very curious, why did we go there when there are other despotic regimes all over the world which we don't intervene with? Was it just to promote democracy? If the information that was forcing us to go in there at the time, which has now turned out to be false, you know, and the urgency of it, the weapons of mass destruction, all of this, yes, we should have a way to be able to intervene in despotic governments, but was this the way to do it? The evidence for that is incredibly thin. And that's the problem I have with that argument. And now, of course,
Mark, let me, if I can, take the part of your argument. I mean, it's not fair to put Anthony in the political analyst seat based on what has happened over here in the past year, because Anthony spent the last year in Iraq. But Anthony, you are back now. You do get a chance to, you know, read in on the news wires and to see and hear now in Washington how political the attention on the war has become. Are you struck by that in any way?
You know, I guess I am struck, and I'm kind of struck in how I think Americans and Iraqis see what's going on differently. And let me kind of give an example of what I mean by that. I remember when Saddam was captured in December, I think it was a seminal moment for a lot of Americans. Here was, you know, in some ways the conclusion of the war. Saddam is now in jail, he's now in custody, and he won't return. I think for a lot of Iraqis it was a footnote. I think his fall in April was at the seminal moment. And then what's going on in their daily lives now is what's defining the American experience in Iraq to a large degree. And I think that's just kind of one example of how sentiments on, you know, across, you know, the sentiments do, they're across a divide. They are very, very different. And, you know, I think while Americans see that, I think a lot of U.S. officials or Americans see, you know, the end of Saddam as the essence of the war and the project of the war, I think a lot of Iraqis see, you know, a dramatic improvement in their lives as the consequence of the war. And, you know, there's a question of whether that's going to happen and how soon.
And as Iraqis look forward to this magic date of June 30th, do they look at that as a moment when finally the Americans will let us run our own affairs, or do they look at that with greater cynicism and say, well, that's just a part of the U.S. political timetable?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of cynicism about that. I don't get the sense that people are looking to June 30th as somehow is going to be a key date in how this experience is unfolding. And I think the elections is a different story. I think the elections will serve to mobilize a lot of people in both good and bad ways, and it could very well be a dramatic moment. My sense is talking to people in Baghdad right now is that June 30th hasn't emerged as that kind of date. You know, when we talk about the American presence, though, again, this is one where we get sentiments that are all over the map, where there is a lot of confusion. And you'll have a conversation with somebody who is a very strident opponent of the U.S. presence in Iraq, who will say in the same conversation that the Americans can't leave, the American military cannot leave because it will be anarchy. And so I think you see it's a very complex relationship that a lot of Iraqis have toward the Americans, you know, frustration with gratitude, you know, dread with anticipation. They're all kind of together. But there's no question that the great majority of Iraqis don't want to see the American military pull out anytime soon.
And what do you look for when you go back later this week? I mean, the one of the last stories that the administration made a lot of noise about here was the signing of the Constitution. Is that something that you'll be covering, or is it simply more of sort of a people in survival mode?
Yeah, I guess what is striking me as a reporter right now in the weeks and months ahead is kind of I don't want to cast in too broad of terms because I run the risk of it not saying anything, but it is kind of the fate of a country in a way. And what is this country becoming? And what forces are shaping it? And who is shaping it? And I think that's something that's very much in flux right now. And there's, I think, probably one of the greatest questions in Iraq today is what is the identity of this country going to be? And there aren't a lot of answers right now about that.
Well, take care of yourself when you go back.
Thank you.
Anthony Shadid, Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He returns to Baghdad on Wednesday. As I mentioned, you can read some of Anthony's feature pieces by following the links on our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Nancy Cohen, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugar. It's Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.